from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, he's widely considered to be the grandfather of green architecture and sustainable design. Architect and UC Berkeley Professor Emeritus Sim van der Rijn was championing innovations like solar roof panels and rainwater catchment systems before most people had ever heard of them. The former state architect of California joins us to reflect on his career and his new book, Design for an Empathic World, Reconnecting to People, Nature, and Self. That's up next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. UC Berkeley Professor Emeritus, former California State Architect, and an architect called the grandfather of green architecture, Sim van der Rijn, joins us in studio for this Forum hour. He recently published Design for an Empathic World, Reconnecting to People, Nature, and Self. And we welcome him. Or welcome back to Forum. Glad to have you here.
Thanks, Michael.
I was thinking about it, sort of reviewing in my mind, because we go back in terms of just having conversations, and I've been familiar with your work now for decades, and I'm thinking to myself, you really helped to start a revolution, sustainable architecture. I mean, you were really there on the ground floor, so to speak, and so much of your work in the Farallones Institute and green buildings and all that has been singular. I just wonder, now, looking at things now, how much do you feel we have advanced in terms of what's been called, maybe too facilely called, a green revolution?
Well, it's...
I knew the sigh was coming somehow.
In the other book I have coming out, you know, which are collected essays, one of the most useful things I did is, starting from now, going back to the 60s, for each decade, I wrote kind of a, you know, one or two page introduction on what was going on in society, and then how that was reflected in architecture. The 70s, I think we had a real shot at it. Then, of course, we got Reagan, and I call that the lost decade. And most of the gains of the 70s were lost then. I mean,
you're talking about in sustainability and green architecture and environmental.
Well, really, I mean, what was the first thing he did? He tore the solar panels off the White House that Carter had put there. He got rid of the Solar and Energy Research Institute, which funded the Marin Solar Village project that I did, which would have converted Hamilton Air Force Base into this incredible, not a suburb, because there are all, but about 1,200 solar units. There would be places to grow food. I've always been interested in the connection between, you know, not just architecture, but energy, water, you know, the basic elements of soil, water, air, space, and sun. And I try and weave those in my projects over years. I try to weave a story of those basic elements into the project. The Real Good Solar Living Center up in Hopland is kind of one example of that, where you can really see all the, you can feel all the systems at work. So, I mean, architecture to me has to be something larger than just building a building. It has to, it really does have to relate and reconnect us to the basic processes of the natural world. That's really been my focus.
Nature, self, and others. That's kind of where you are in this new book as far as what architecture should do, or design of any kind, yeah?
Yeah.
That's the triad, I mean, in terms of connection.
It's people, nature, and ourselves.
And on that score, we're not doing as well as we should, I'm taking it. Would you give us a grade as far as where we are?
Well,
the former professor? maybe a gentleman C or something like that?
I think, you know, one of the things I write about is, you know, we have this institution now, the U.S. Green Building Council, and and what they do is they have this LEED system, point system, And but for example, I mean, here's what happens. If you want to get a, and this is another, if you want to get a gold plaque for having this highly energy efficient building and so forth, you have to get 35 points out of I think 70 for an energy efficient mechanical system, heating and cooling system. Well, I've done buildings that have none. And I never apply for the award because I know, well, they tell me all you can get is 2 points for innovation, so you can never get the gold plaque. Plus, but my main complaint is, one of the big complaint in architecture has been, and it goes back to the roots of architecture. Where does architecture actually come from? I remember in 1963, President Kennedy came out to do the Charter Day Address in Berkeley. And so there's a mad rush by faculty to get their robes, faculty robes. So I'm on the line, and they say, "What discipline are you?" I say, "Architecture." And the fellow says, "Well, I'm sorry, we're all out of architecture robes. How would you like agriculture?" And I kind of look at him. What are you talking about? I'm not a farmer. And Catherine Bauer Worcester, who with her husband William Worcester founded the College of Environmental Design about 50 years ago, happened to be behind me in line and tapped me on the shoulder. Said, "Sim, don't you understand? There is no architecture until there is agriculture and food surpluses. That's really the basis." the basis of architecture.
I thought they were just looking alphabetically and said something along those lines. Beginning with A, we're talking to Sim van der Rijn, whose new book is called Design for an Empathic World, Reconnecting to People, Nature, and Self, and it includes some of his watercolors, which are really pretty good, and a lot of self-discovery and meditation that's gone on through something he's been doing since he was a kid, really. But you start off in the text talking about the difference between seeing and looking.
Yeah.
And you get into this whole sense of an inner self. Talk about that. I mean, where does it tie in with design and architecture?
Where what?
Where does it tie in with design and architecture?
I think that's one of the reasons that's part of the problem. It generally doesn't tie into architecture. As I say, you know, since the agricultural revolution 5,000 years ago, when people could actually build permanent buildings, there were no architects. I mean, there were master builders, and there, but that was all. You know, there were pharaohs, kings, and so forth, and that's who we still tend to serve in our profession. You serve power, and you do what power tells you to do. Richard Farson, who you may know, the psychologist who's head of the Western Behavioral Sciences Center, he got interested in architecture. He was on the board for quite a while, the American Institute of Architects, and he wrote a book in 2005 called The Power of Design. And one of the things he talks about is, you know, is architecture a business or is a profession that has some ethics? And he comes to the conclusion that we pretend to be both. And I think that's, you know, that's a difficult game. And what I'm saying is you tend to blindly, I just see that architecture just, you know, corporations, whether it's government or corporations, there's not enough people at the table. It's not a collaborative process. You don't bring in the actual users of buildings. That was my critique of the LEED system.
You did that whole post-occupancy evaluation group, I remember, and this is really comes back to the argument you have here again. The design leaves out the who's inside.
Exactly. I mean, I can remember some years back, Cisco Systems is going to build a whole new complex in south of San Jose, and they were interviewing me, and I started talking about natural light, and the vice president for real estate or whatever he was kind of looked at me and said, "No, our employees don't want any windows into buildings.
We want to talk about the UC Berkeley dorms in this context.
Well, that was one.
You did an early study on those.
I studied my first, my monograph for the Ford Foundation was, Berkeley had decided in the early 60s, we need all this student housing. They cleared out two blocks, and what they built was a cluster of 10-story high, basically hotels, two students to a room. And I remember at the time it got, when newspapers still had architectural critics, there was these great reviews, and John Warnke, who was the architect, got all these awards for these buildings. And I said, gee, when I'm teaching a research seminar, when are we really, they're right across the street from us, why don't we spend the semester really studying the buildings, doing some basic social science, doing interviews, observation, and seeing how the places actually work. And actually, then a few years later, those buildings had very high vacancies. But the whole point was, and it was based on, the 60s attitude, at least mine, was distrust authority. Someone in administration, students would love to be in hotels, but for 4 years or 1 year. So we found out, that they really didn't work very well for a place to study, contemplate. It was great for playing Frisbee in the halls and other pranks.
We're talking with former California State architect and Professor Emeritus of Architecture at UC Berkeley, Sim van der Rijn, and his new book is called Design for an Empathic World, Reconnecting to People, Nature, and Self. You make a case here, an advocacy for early design experiences in childhood education.
What
do you have in mind?
What do I have in mind? Well, exactly. I mean, architectural education. Well, when I went to school, you could get a BA in architecture just like in 4 years. Now it's generally a graduate program. So you've gone through 12 years of primary education and secondary education. Then you've gone to college for 4 years, and now you're going to decide to study architecture. And that to me is, it just really doesn't make any sense. Design and relating to our environments, both natural ones and built ones, developing that kind of awareness and needs to happen, in my view, preschool and all the way through. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, we were asked by San Domenico School, Sister Gervais, who's head of the school, to start to incorporate design. And they wanted the kind of quote-unquote sustainability curriculum from preschool right through high school, in which we did that. And it was quite amazing because I could get fourth graders to do the same thing we had freshmen do in architecture classes, and I could get high school students to do the work that, that professionals, they mapped the whole site. you can't leave it for when you're, been through all this education and experience and then start to learn this stuff. I mean, I just think it needs to start much earlier, and I think we'd have better environments if it started earlier. At Farallon's, we started in our gardens. We started programs to teach teachers how to grow food, and we did. And that's the same thing we did at San Domenico. And I remember at first, parents would complain some of their kids could come home muddy. We were also building buildings out of straw and soil from the creek. And, parents complained, the kids are coming home, they got mud on them or something. And then pretty soon that summer, the parents came and they kind of
they brought home some mud too. There's a sense that you're trying to essentially communicate a kind of visionary notion that we have to tie empathy, an overused word, I might add, to design, and that we kind of left this human-centered design and design that really puts a high priority on the human side, who's occupying, all those kinds of things. That was part of the 60s and the whole counterculture, and now
that's true.
Kind of have to decide where we are at this point,
exactly.
Where we want to go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, initially, I didn't really want to write this book because I said, well, I know all the things that are wrong with our systems. I think one of the big problems in our society today is that we know that people who really care, but many of them, like peak oil, but it's all gets to be fear-based. What's coming down and it's presented in a fear-based message, which just turns people off. And then they just really want to be in denial from it. So I think we need, what's been lost is where's the sense of the common good? my partner and I was awarded a Rockefeller Fellowship. They have this incredible center in Bellagio in Italy, on Lake Como. And there were a number of African leaders there, and that's what they were talking about. And these were, where is the common good? Where is our concern for the common good? And so I think it has to be recreated. I think all of this has to be recreated in communities. And by people really getting together and doing it. And our institutions can help if they really paid attention.
Well, it's a good place maybe to go back with you in time because you were involved with People's Park Movement back in Berkeley back in the day, and you called it participatory design in action.
Yeah, I want design to be a collaborative. I want it to be a collaborative activity.
Collectivist. Yeah,
a collectivist activity rather than, so many of our institutions are siloed into, Well, it's just like I can remember, we'd have, and I'm sure you remember from your days, teaching days, we'd have these interdisciplinary seminars sometimes. And the idea was nice. You sit around a table, but, the social scientist would talk with the social science hat on, and the architect would talk to the architect hat on, ad infinitum. And it really wasn't – it didn't feel like a really human connection where we're really talking in one language rather than 10 technical languages about how something
we need Esperanto.
Happen.
That's what we really need. I've got to ask you something. So we talk about the 60s because you write about figures who had a lot of influence on those of us who went through the 60s or were marinated in the 60s. I mean, you mentioned Gregory Bateson and you mentioned Carlos Castaneda and people like that and so forth. Are they still as relevant today?
I think so. There's a quote I have from Castaneda, which is really good, about if you feel a path is wrong, don't follow it. Which also actually was kind of when I decided, I think maybe I do have some positive things to say. And it kind of started with what happened after the economic meltdown when I got all these calls from, panicked architects who just, because architecture just collapsed. And
they were looking for work, yeah. Basically.
Yes, they were looking for work. And I'd get these calls, and they'd say, I feel lost. And first I didn't have an answer for them. Well, go look for a job some more. And then I thought about, one of the reasons I started teaching rather than just working, year-round in an architectural office was I wanted time for myself, and I would go backpacking by myself in the Sierras. And there would be days, I'd get to be about 5 o'clock, and we didn't have GPS. And I'd look at the map, and I'd say, I'm lost. I don't know where I am. You know, and sense of panic. And then take some deep breaths and find a safe place inside. And that's what I started telling these people who would call. And that took me really on a whole journey, too. I mean,
you started getting pretty philosophical about how people need to care for others and also...
And care for themselves.
For themselves.
You know, yeah. One of my mentors, talk about mentors, Brother David Steindl-Rast.
I know him well.
Yeah. Yeah, we visit occasionally. But he's, you know, he writes a lot about gratefulness. Well, if you asked me back in the 60s about what does gratitude mean, I'd say, oh, that's just another hippie term, you know. But I think particularly in the last 10 years, I've learned what gratitude is and feels like.
What is gratitude then to you now?
It is feeling every day I just feel grateful to be alive, to live where I do, to have the friends, the community that I live in. It's a feeling of beauty and of beauty and of love and of aliveness, not just for myself, but for my family.
But it's an aesthetic too?
Oh, definitely. Well, that's where the watercolors come in. I'm never, you know, the time I'm doing watercolors, I'm not thinking about it that way. But that you ask the question, the difference between looking and seeing. Looking, and we can see this with people looking at their iPhones or people, you know, tourists getting that picture of the Golden Gate Bridge. Well, that's fine, but that's a separation. And seeing is something that's deeply connected and internal to what it is that you're experiencing.
Let me quote Adrian Rich, what we see and seeing is changing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let me invite those of you listening to join us with Sim Van der Rijn. I'd be interested in hearing some thoughts from some of you or reflections on what good design ought to mean and how much design ought to bring in those for whom the building, let's say, or the edifice or whatever we're talking about, the dormitory is being designed for, how much do you think that really generally contemporary architecture takes into account those who are in the buildings or those who are in whatever is being designed? Also, talking about nature and the connection between nature and design and feeling more of a empathy with nature. Sim Van der Rijn is a longtime environmentalist and ecology advocate and writes about a lot of these connections with respect to being concerned about climate change and being concerned about just the nature of the planet. But we welcome your involvement in the conversation. And you can join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Welcome your involvement. Any questions or comments? 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. The real sense of what this book represents, I think, is making us more aware of our relation to ourselves, to others, and to nature, and how they're all synergistic and they all tie in together in a kind of ecosystem of their own. Our guest again, former California architect and UC Berkeley Professor Emeritus of Architecture, Sim Van der Rijn, and you will be part of the program when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking this hour with Sim Van der Rijn, who spent 35 years as professor of architecture at UC Berkeley, has been called, among other things, grandfather of green architecture and sustainable design, and also was California State Architect for Governor Jerry Brown back in his first incarnation as governor in the 70s. He's also, Sim Van der Rijn, the author of 8 books, including his latest, Design for an Empathic World, Reconnecting to People, Nature, and Self. And on the 22nd of February, he will be at Point Reyes Books hosting a Design for an Empathic World workshop with 3 of his colleagues. And anybody interested in how design needs to reconnect people, nature, and ourselves in these uncertain times of immense change, may indeed want to attend. You can also let us know what you think about this concept or bring anything into the conversation of your choice by calling us 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Many ways, obviously, to communicate. And I'm going to go to your calls and emails just in a second here, but let's talk just for a minute, Sim, about your experience with that first Brown administration. You know, were you able to apply the ideas that really you were so solidly wedded to from the 60s in that role?
Absolutely. Man, I don't know whether it was luck or passion. Well, a lot of it was Jerry's support. You know, I think Jerry's greatest gift, particularly in that first term, was that, you know, he would, and I think he said it in his commercials when he's running this time, is, you know, I have an insider's mind. I have an insider's knowledge, but an outsider's mind. And he brought into that first administration all these outliers, like, you know, if not outlaws, such as me, Bob Genesda, and well, in every department.
Rose Byrd. We're going to be talking to Ron George tomorrow, so she comes swiftly to mind. Yeah.
During that first term, one thing, because I had a long negotiation with him because I had just started the Farallon's Rural Center, and I'd spent 3 years getting that off the ground, and this was a place where you could put those elements together. It was learning how to grow food. It was learning how to use less water. It was learning how to build with nature, particularly with the sun. And it was hard to walk away from that. And so I had a whole series of meetings with him. You know, he's trying to convince me I should take this job. And I said, I'm honored, but I'm committed to this project. And one of the things I got, I realized, okay, that my operation had, I don't know how many hundreds of, you know, civil service, wonderful people. But I also wanted to bring in some other kinds of people. To basically what I said is, well, we need a David to fight the Goliath of bureaucracy. So he created in his office the Office of Appropriate Technology. That would now be called sustainability, which is a word I don't like very much. I'd rather call it Office of Resiliency, but Office OAT. And we had a small staff, but they didn't have to be civil. They didn't have to be civil service, so I could handpick other kind of really smart people outside of the system. And we did, we gave awards to community. We did all kinds of stuff. We really networked around the state with other people who were trying to make good things happen.
Let's make some of our calls happen. First caller is Bob from Sonoma. Hi, Bob.
Hey, hi, Michael. I had a question with regard to participatory design. Charles Moore, who you probably know him,
was a
kind of a thinker and a kind of a dreamer, but he also was very inclusive when it came to those kinds of efforts to bring the WHO back into design. Do you know of any groups now that would aspire to that, so that students can kind of get a firsthand look at how that happened?
I'm glad you brought up Charles Moore, because and one thing I write about in the book is that, I mean, today, you know, all these administrators would have to have MBAs and be looking at the bottom line. I was very lucky in my career that there were people like Charles who were gentle, who really had heart and were very supportive. The person, there are people around at various universities who are doing participatory and collaborative design. The person I'm most impressed with now, who's here in the Bay Area, was actually a Berkeley graduate, is called Emily Pilleton, and she has Project H.
She's going to be with you February 22nd at that point.
Yeah, what she's doing, working Berkeley charter schools, like over the summer, she was teaching, you know, 9 to 12-year-old girls how to weld, how to build. And that's the other thing, the hands-on component. Architecture is just too airy. You know, and to me, And there always was a blue collar, white collar division in architecture. You know, those blue collar guys that they're dummies. They don't know anything, and that's not true. I mean, I learn a lot from the construction workers and that I've known over the years. So that's another thing, is to not have it so siloed between I'm the designer and one on one hand and you're the builder on the other hand. That creates a lot of problems.
Let me thank Bob for the call. And again, we're talking to Sim van der Rijn, and we're going to another caller. Keith, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, so interesting you mentioned Gregory Bateson and Sim. So I've been a longtime fan. Christopher Alexander, the pattern language. Uh-huh. People like William Irwin Thompson and others in the 70s.
Yeah.
We're starting to see now this focus on design. So not to overstate it, but you've got MBAs now looking at the design school at Stanford, and uh-huh. a lot of companies beginning to incorporate design into both everyday objects and environments we interact in. And I'll take my call off the air, but I was just wondering, do you see this as a positive trend? Do you see this more just around sort of product design, and just sort of what your thoughts are on this whole idea of beginning to focus more and more in design in the everyday life?
All right, Keith, thank you for the question.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I do think it's a positive design. I did a talk with one of the Google people who's doing that, where Google is a company that seems to really care about, that is paying attention to what its employees want and how, you know, I mean, a lot of us have seen it. No, I think that flattening, that broadening out design is a direction we need to go in, rather than having it siloed as industrial design and as architecture and as this and that. You know,
Can we just bring us all together, huh? I mean, those who are involved
in the same earlier.
Project. Yeah.
Yeah, start earlier. And we need to have it happen earlier, not in a master's program.
Here's an interesting question from a listener named Robert that ties in a bit. He says, for those of us already convinced, where do we go to get the technical information to actually build an affordable greenhouse? I'm interested in real sources for passive solar design, natural light and ventilation, and so on, as well as an architect or designer who is interested in such small and individual projects.
Yeah, that's another good question. Well,
feel free to recommend somebody or something if you want, yeah.
Well, a person who I think is really done a lot is Michelle Kaufman, and she developed what's now the Blue House. She developed just before the meltdown, she had developed some really wonderful, the Glide House, she's really one of the truly greenest architects that I know.
And she's local.
She's local. I believe she's on the Google X team now.
Well, here's Joseph, who says, world energy use or any other resource use tracks GDP. Since resource use is necessarily ecologically damaging, doesn't it follow that cheaper designs are more ecological regardless of greenness?
Well, absolutely, and that's a point that's being made more and more. You know, we're not going to be saved by these new technologies so long as our consumption goes on the path that it's on, and we're just adding more bells and whistles, more green bells and whistles. I think it all really needs to be rethought. I mean, the size of homes has gone up drastically. I mean, I did a house for someone which was in terms of materials and construction systems very green, but in terms of size for four people, it was I believe 18,000 square feet. And actually, I thought he was going to fire me because the New York Times wrote a piece about Jolly green giant homes. And I said, I don't consider it a green home because the size isn't commensurate with the need. And he agreed with me, actually.
There's another caller joining us. Sarn, you're on. Good morning.
Me?
I'm sorry. Sam. Excuse me.
Yes, that's me. I have a question I've been curious about and furious about for years and years and years. Why have architects never noticed that women urinate differently from men and therefore require more time? You go to any public building during the opera, concert, whatever, in the intermissions, you'll see huge queues outside the ladies' lavatory. The same thing in buildings such as the Bibliothèque Nationale. Queues!
Well,
and men whisk in and out. Why is it that architects have never noticed this? Why is it that architects do not provide more restrooms for women?
Probably because they've never really studied the problem. maybe they see it, but they don't really relate it to what they do. It's this whole issue.
We need more women architects, too, though.
Absolutely, we need more women architects. But that alone even won't do the job because the client needs to be convinced that just what you're saying. I see that all the time. I see it in airports. that's a really good point. So maybe we got to teach the schools could teach something in toilet matters, toilet matters and toilet matters.
Well, Sam, thank you for that. And let me bring another caller on here, and that's Peter from San Geronimo. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm an ex-contractor, and I was building during the 70s, and the state gave incentives to build green. So we're doing passive green. Reagan came along and retarded and removed all these things. So I'd like to know or have you speculate on how much Reagan has hindered any kind of reasonable or green building. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thank you for that. Actually, Sim, you'd already said that Reagan set us back. We were on a good trajectory, and you pretty much described it as going backward with Reagan.
Yeah.
So I guess we've answered that. Robert writes, my neighbors and I had to figure out how to replace the 30-year-old roofs of three multi-dwelling buildings with elaborate roof collectors serving potable water, heat exchanger preheaters. The premium for removing, storing, and replacing the collectors exceeded $300,000 on top of the roof replacement, doubling the total cost of the project. The collectors are gone. Another listener, Bill, writes, I have a strong disagreement with the LEED program. That's the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. Builders get brownie points for building a massively strong roof structure to pile tons of dirt on it for a living roof when a simple shade tree would solve the same problem with a lightweight structure. There are no deductions for massive excavations that need enormous amounts of truck traffic to move dirt to a landfill and huge concrete retaining walls. There are no deductions for building huge 5,000-square-foot houses for a single family. The program is a farce. Comment.
I agree with all that. I used to be invited to be kind of the provocateur at the board meetings of USGBC that has the LEED program. And I said, I'm not the only one who said it to him too, I think, is it shouldn't be LEED, it should be LEAP. Leadership in Energy and Environmental Performance. That means you don't give the awards based on design assumptions that people turn in these numbers. It's post occupancy evaluation. They're talking about doing that, but it's very slow. Who's really doing it is the Living Building Challenge and the Living Building Institute that's based in Seattle. Jason McLennan, who kindly wrote a beautiful foreword for my book. I've known him for years. He is the true crusader for this. He has a living building challenge where to be a living building, you have to do four things. It has to be zero water. It has to be zero energy, and it has to be zero waste. I used to be called Captain Compost because I was always obsessed, for a long time, I was obsessed with this. Why do we take one reusable resource, our own human waste, dilute it with another precious resource, potable water, and then pollute maybe they add chemicals, but basically it turns into polluting.
We're back to toilets.
back to toilets. I was just recently in Seattle on the book tour and went through the Bullitt Building. Dennis Hayes, the 22-year-old who organized Earth Day, he's head of the Bullitt Foundation. He went for the Living Building Challenge. They have a 5-story building, which to me was my dream come true. It's 100% solar. All the water is reclaimed and reused. And then I saw the wonderful they have 5-story composting toilets. The one thing that's the only thing that does leave the site is the finished compost is taken to a farm somewhere. But people should check out the Living Building Challenge and forget about this LEED stuff and the U.S. Green Building Council, because it's too late, too little, and it's too late, and it's too rigged in favor of some things and not in favor of others, as one of the callers pointed out.
And here's George joining us. George, you're on.
Hi, one question and comment. In the early 70s, I was at a part-time job teaching architecture students at Cal on how to look at behavior in environments, something they didn't get in the curriculum. And it seemed to me that most of them came in as either engineers, wanting to be engineers or artists, and really there was no opportunity for them to understand how individuals and social groups use environments and shape them, modify them, and react to them. So I wonder if that's changed at all. And then the other question I had is, in the late 60s, there was a wonderful book called Design with Nature. I think it was Ian McCarg.
Yes.
And, he used a series of, like, just plastic overlays to show how different systems, physical and biological and chemical systems, were connected and overlaid on each other. Now we have extraordinary power to simulate environments and actually have people design environments that they can walk around with, where there are all the linkages with social and environmental and physical systems. And I wonder how you felt about that. It's high tech, but it actually gives people a way to experience the pleasures and costs of different kinds of designs without actually having to build a structure. So it's an educational tool.
And you're referring to the McCarg. This is now kind of a McCargian system?
Okay. Well, no, I'm not specifically. I'm referring to really what could be you could think of it as a SimCity kind of approach.
Oh.
I do complex system simulation myself, but this is an area where I don't think we have a lot of use of it.
I particularly agree with your first comments about that in the architecture school, the kind of really understanding the how things really work with people in the real world is largely ignored because it's a broken model. It's really what I call it the Ayn Rand model of design, because it comes out from the Beaux-Arts schools, and it is, you're a genius, because in a studio you're supposed to generally work alone for 10 or 12 weeks and have these wonderful ideas and then present them to these jury of other professors who just want to outdo each other in their cleverness and cynical cynicism. It is really a broken system, and that I think all the comments that we're getting today are really reinforcing the need for a change in the education system and design and architecture.
And again, Sim van Nieuwenhuyzen's new book is Design for an Empathic World, Reconnecting to People, Nature, and Self. We've got some other opinions from our website I want to read here quickly. Clifford says, it's quite likely that a building's use will change over time. New buildings need to be designed more generically, more simply, to be more open to changing patterns of needs and use. And Erica writes, my father worked at a psychiatric hospital that was designed by Frank Gehry. He thought it was an awful building. Gehry made windows similar to a prison and made no consideration for the fact that it would be housing seriously mentally ill patients. Buildings are built to be occupied by people and should take that into consideration. And I expect Sim van Nieuwenhuyzen says, hear, hear to that. And it's an interesting question a listener poses, a listener named Fiza. Why is it that being in wilderness or the woods, we feel more happy than we feel when we're around buildings, skyscrapers, concrete, etc.? How do you tackle this issue as an architect? And what does nature provide us that man-made design doesn't?
nature provides us life that's constantly alive, you know.
It's outdoor space, though, too. I mean, as opposed to being enclosed.
Well, as I say, you know.
Brick and mortar and.
And I wrote in one time.
Trees and sky, yeah.
I have nothing against cities. I don't live in one. And I remember writing, you know, a poem one time that started and said that said, I like to build in places where nature is foreground and not background. Mm. But the real challenge, we can truly green our cities, not with money, but with living nature, whether it's roofs. I mean, when I was teaching, we took San Francisco, we went up the Sierra and just to see these rock walls covered with vines and growing things. We could be doing that with all these skyscrapers. I think that's the real challenge. You know, we got a very thin epidermis in our cities, and it's not alive. It's asphalt, it's metal, it's glass, it's all that other stuff. It can truly be greened with a living world.
And we go to Berkeley again. Amy, join us. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Good morning. I wanted to thank you so much for this program. I'm a faculty member in engineering at UC Berkeley, and I just really resonate with some of the comments that the visitor, your professor, is speaking about. I do want to just make the point that this whole focus on empathetic design is really having a resurgence in the engineering disciplines right now, and probably actually for the last couple of decades. I just want to give a couple of specific examples. Our undergraduates right now are just really going out of the classroom, leaving campus, and embedding themselves in environments where their engineering innovations will eventually be used. Some of this work is funded by the National Institutes of Health, actually. And so the undergraduate students are spending lots of time with clinicians, with nurses, and with other individuals that either use or are the beneficiaries of, for example, medical technology. And they're doing that really, really early to try to understand how they think their innovation can impact, but really how it could, and in many cases, how their initial ideas really can't. And so we call this needs finding, and I think that's an important part of engineering that really ties to this concept of being able to empathetically design well for the end user and to have a real impact. The last thing I just wanted to mention is at Berkeley in particular, we have a new institute that's coming up, the Jacobs Institute for Innovative Design or Design Innovation, that's really going to be focused as a nexus to bring together all of our engineering disciplines, but also architecture and art and arts and information science, as well as these end users, to try to really embed their voice early in the engineering design process.
Oh, we thank you for the call. In fact, as long as we're talking about Berkeley for the moment, here's Holly, who writes, I was an 18-year-old college student at Berkeley who worked with Sim and other luminaries at the Farallones Institute at the Integral Urban House in Berkeley and the Rural Center in Occidental, California. Please have him elaborate on those two research and demonstration centers in the book we did for Sierra Club Books. We gave tours of these urban and rural centers that showed people how to increase the energy efficiency in their houses, install solar and other home-scale energy systems, plant edible and ecologically sound gardens in homes and schools. Well, she kind of covered the waterfront a bit there. You want to talk about those?
I want to go to Amy's comment because I think it's...
Go to Amy's comment.
Yes, the books are out. The books, Sustainable Communities, has a lot about the Farallones. The Integral Urban House book, the Integral Urban House that we converted this wreck of a house in Berkeley into an example where we could grow food, where we could save water and so on. Fine Home Building, in their anniversary edition, they had the 25 best homes built since the white people came to this country. They should have had some Native American examples, but they didn't. And the Integral Urban House was one of those. But what Amy says, I really would like to get in touch with her because that's exactly what she describes is exactly what is happening. And it's interesting NIH is supporting it because my early work was funded by National Institute of Mental Health. All the user studies that we did, they were funding.
Amy can get in touch with you. Is there an just email us, forum@kqed.org, and we'll put the two of you in touch.
That would be great.
And we'll go to another caller, and that's Steve in San Mateo. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing? I was in L.A. in the early to mid-70s in architecture, specifically at SciArc. And I watched a lot of the green, more conscious architects essentially get forced out of the spotlight and be replaced by all those people that were involved in postmodernism. And they made all of the tours and all of that. I was wondering if you could make a comment on how the education, I know you were up in Berkeley, but how the education failed the Green Movement in the mid-70s. And could you comment on that and then say, where are we going to go in the future from just an educational perspective? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Sim?
Well, I totally agree with what you're saying. There's just this antique model of the building as object or the building or statement with no interest in people or nature. It's just, you know, the building is – no, buildings are not objects. Buildings are ecosystems with living people inside and a living nature outside. And no, the problem is still the same, that the schools haven't really woken up as to what the real potential is and the real needs are. They're dealing mostly with fantasy. And now that every student uses a computer, they can create all the fantasies they want.
What would you say to young – we got seconds left here – young architects, prospective architects – in seconds.
Young architects, go out and work, not as an architect. You don't need to work as an architect. Get involved in building, and architecture will come.
Sim van der Rijn, good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you for being a part of this morning. This program, and by the way, February 22nd, he'll be at Point Reyes Books, pointreyesbooks.com, to get more information about that. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.